All financial advice provided on this show is for entertainment and educational purposes only. The financial ideas and strategies discussed are only provided as a starting point for a conversation about money matters. With regard to your particular investments and financial strategies, consult your financial planner, CPA, or investment professional. All your financial decisions are yours and yours alone to make and subsequently are solely your responsibility. The information that is supplied through the context of the radio program and any repurposing of its content by the host or network is a combination and collection of solid financial investment understanding, opinion, and comments. This network, show, and its host are not liable for financial strategies, outcomes that you employ in any manner that result in any kind of loss. Shares of corporate sponsors may be the subject of buy or sell recommendations in Jay Taylor's newsletter in accordance with Jay's objective opinion.
Welcome to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor. Speaking to you from the borough of Queens in New York City, it is the 15th day of March, 2023. Really happy to tell you that Cheri Leadon is with me. She is the CEO of Gold Bull Resources, and they are the sponsors for today's show. I have been following now Gold Bull Resources over the past year or so. It is a minuscule, has a minuscule market cap, but it has nearly 500,000 ounces of gold in its resource with lots of exploration potential. It's certainly, in my view, a story that not too many people are paying attention to, but they should. And that's why I'm really happy to have Cheri with me. She is a very experienced geologist. She worked with Rio Tinto, for example, for a number of years. She's 20 years or so in as a geologist, and the last 10 years have been at the CEO level of, I think, more junior mining companies, perhaps, but at least this is the one that I know her from, and really happy to welcome Cheri. Thanks for joining me, Cheri.
Thank you very much, Jay.
Yeah, before we get started, I guess I should tell people that your shares trade in Canada under the symbol C or GBRC, and you can buy them down here in the States as I have under GBRCF. Just a little under 100 million shares outstanding, and as I mentioned, a minuscule market cap, $6 million U.S. money. I guess that'd be about 8 million in Canada, but either way you measure it, it's minuscule. Your company has something just under 500,000 ounces. I think they're oxide ounces, probably, maybe heap leachable ounces, but anyway, let's get into that. You have a 494,000 ounce resource. And that was in 2021, I think it was. I believe you've done some work since then. Is there any chance of upgrading that resource anytime soon?
Yeah, we definitely see the resource growing in the right direction, but we'd like to put some more holes in it before we come out with our resource estimate increase to make it meaningful. Essentially, what we're seeing is we're seeing gradual resource increases around the known resource where the resources remain open. When we purchased the project from Newmont in 2020, it only had 290,000 ounces. So We've already come out with one incremental increase to just shy of 500,000 ounces. And I'd like to see one more drill program before we come out with the next increase to make it meaningful.
Yeah. And I believe those resources are from four pits, mostly from four pits. Maybe there's a fifth pit, but mostly, and they're right on surface, as I understand it, or very close to surface. They're all oxides, I guess, and heap leachable. And I think you've done some metallurgy and that come out quite good.
Yeah, so we've got four deposits within the Sandman project, and they're all between 100 and 150,000 ounces at the moment. Most of them remain open. The ones in the north are all oxide, and we've got the two deposits in the south oxide for the first about 100 meters, and then it transitions into sulfide. So they behave a bit differently, but the metallurgy has been excellent for the top oxide, which we'll process by the proposed heap leach, and also the sulfide material recovers very nicely as well. And there's some nearby facilities for that.
Well, I believe those pits are pretty close together, are they not?
They are. You know, to drive from the furthest north to the south takes about 10 minutes drive. In our proposed preliminary economic assessment, we look at actually having two discrete operations, so two discrete heat leaches. So rather than trucking it that 10 minutes or so, it worked out cheaper just to have two discrete operations, one in the north and one in the south. That's not going to add much more capital, yet it's going to reduce our operating costs.
Right. And you've done a PEA, I think?
We have, yes. We announced that late last year. And the economics were quite sensational. NPV of $77 million, payback period of just over a year. a 99% IRR, and that was based on 35,000 ounce per annum mining operation, and essentially going from one pit to the next pit to the next pit, average grade of 0.74 grams a ton, all oxide, all above the water table, low strip ratio of 1.6 to 1. So, and we thought those economics would really motivate the market, and that was based only on 50% of our resource located above the water table. So now we're actually doing a PEA that looks at all the resource, so all the half a million ounces. So what impact that will have is, instead of being a 5-year mine life, we'll jump to a 10-year mine life. I'm expecting the NPV to almost double, and a lot of that other economic parameters, as you would expect when we look at double the resource.
Well, of course, 35,000 ounces is a pretty small operation. Not too many of them are, you know, the markets don't reward small operations usually like they do the bigger guys. It's my understanding though that you may be toying with the idea, you and your board, that to put in for some production, perhaps to generate some cash flows to be able to finance a bigger, you know, larger scale exploration. Do I have that right?
Yes, spot on, Jay. For us, 35,000 ounces per annum is not the end goal or the the target. As you said, I'm ex-Rio, so is our chairman, Craig Perry. And, you know, we're looking for plus 100,000 ounce per annum operations. And we generally believe Sandman boasts the exploration potential to have multi-million ounce discovery there, such as Sleeper, a Sleeper mine, a couple of million ounces of high grade, located about 15 miles to the north on the same geological trend. So we're looking for another Sleeper. And for us, the half a million ounces is the start. You know, in this market, it hasn't been easy in the junior gold space since we created Gold Bull during COVID. So we had the, it's almost an Australian model where you start small and then you self-fund your exploration out of your production revenue. And, you know, a small scale producer like that will pump out $20, $25 million US per annum. And that's really significant with respect to an exploration budget. We don't want to be, we can't, you know, with our current market cap, be raising that kind of money for exploration. So that was the model. And to be honest, it hasn't been received as favorably on the TSX as we had hoped. Our top 10 shareholders are pretty supportive of it, but a lot of them are Aussie, and they, you know, they get the small scale producer model. So that's why we're looking at the revised PEA, which will, you know, increase the mine life and increase the economics just to something a bit more meaningful. And I expect that'll be out by April.
Right. You know, as I looked at your some illustrations on your website showing those pits that are close together, and I have to think that gold doesn't fall out of the sky and just fall on the ground. It comes from deep down under. And I have to wonder, any ideas about some deep drill holes to try to find out where the mothership might be for this, for these surface expressions?
So we've had a couple of advisors to our project who are a lot smarter than I am with respect to epithermal deposits. So we've had John Wood, who discovered Sleeper, advising us over the last couple of years. And we've also had Simon Meldrum, another epithermal guru. And those guys are basically seeing our current half a million ounces as anomalies. You know, so we've got half a million ounces in the top 100 meters spread over the project, but where is that coming from? And what's the plumbing doing underneath that half a million ounces? You know, where does it all connect up? So we're thinking bigger picture with respect to our exploration program, because up until this year, there's always been a bias around these known pits because there's data. Everyone, including ourselves, keep going to the known half a million ounces, keep trying to expand that incrementally. But in 2023, we're actually stepping back from that. We're almost like deleting those data points, and we're looking at the plumbing system. We're taking a new approach, looking for, it's called a mineral called Buddingtonite. And this particular mineral is, it's hard to identify in the field because looking at the rock, you can't see it. You need a special scanning tool, hyperspectral tool, to actually identify this alteration mineral. But when you find this mineral, you typically find the Bonanza Gold vein. So that's a trick that John Wood has put us onto. And it's actually a very low cost exploration method. It involves a lot of boots on ground, hyperspectral, you know, good old fashioned science, which has really been lacking, I'd say, in the state over the last, you know, 20 years. We've had this reliance on the drill bit rather than stepping back and looking at these new target areas. So we're very eager for the snow to melt to allow our geos to get back on the ground and start that work, I'd say probably in the coming weeks.
Right. So do you have your program set up for 2023? You're going to do some drilling. I know you don't have a lot of money in the till now, I believe, but, and you're going to have to raise some probably. But some of what you're talking about sounds like maybe lower cost exploration to get set up for drilling.
Yeah, absolutely. For now, the priority is looking for more sleeper targets. So that's going to take us, 3 to 6 months of on the groundwork, and it's going to cost you only a few hundred thousand dollars, which is relatively light budget. It's predominantly on boots on ground salaries. So once we've got our Buddingtonite targets, then we'll have our define our drill program. So it's a bit premature to talk about a program until we know how many targets we're going to have to drill test. So as soon as we finish that, complete that work program, which the start time, somewhat dependent on the snow melt, we'll be out on the ground and defining those new targets, and we'll certainly share them with the market as we define new Buddingtonite sleeper targets.
Right. Well, so you'll start the snow melts. Well, you have a lot of snow this year, I understand, up there, maybe more than
Well, we
usual.
have a lot in Tahoe. Winnemucca is not so bad. There's
Oh,
only a
okay.
couple of inches in Winnemucca where the project's located. So I anticipate, with a bit of rain, that will be washed away in no time, and we can get back out in the ground. And in parallel to that, we've got our PEA underway. So we've
Oh,
got an
good.
engineer working on our PEA. We've also got some long lead permitting items that I'd like to get going, just because the permit process in the US takes years. So we can do a lot of that in parallel to the studies we're currently doing. So when the decision comes to create the mine, we're not starting that years from then, but from now for our monitoring, biological monitoring, water monitoring, and so forth.
Right. So a PEA is coming out. How soon might we expect that?
I hope in April. I
Oh,
expect it in
okay.
April.
Yeah, good. Well, that's certainly then one share price driver potentially. I guess that along with, I mean, it just seems to me that, I'm familiar with the Sleeper deposit. I was a banker and was involved with Westpac Banking Corp. In fact, it was one of the finance one of the group of banks that provided the first gold loan in modern times for the Sleeper mine. They had an incredibly high I don't know how wide it was, I don't remember anymore, but like multiple ounces. I mean, it just, right? It, incredibly high grade.
One of the highest grade deposits in the state, and we're essentially along the same structure, the same geology, same rocks. So that's what gives us hope that all these little deposits, these cumulative 500,000 ounces, we believe is just really the smoke above the fire. And it's using good science, robust science, to narrow down our drill targets to explore them in the second half of this year.
Yeah, well, it's certainly, I guess, yeah, I mean, it has the potential. I mean, a $6 million US $6 million market cap. Nobody's paying attention. When the market starts to heat up, a good PEA, I think it's pretty exciting, actually. Company is going to have to raise money, though, at some point. Accredited investors, is it open, or do you have your sources lined up pretty much for financing?
We're always open to new investors, but we're not looking to raise anytime soon. We
Right.
believe that we can add more value where we've got enough money to get us through to the end of this year in the bank. And we've also got a lot of other interesting ideas, like essentially low to no cost M&A activity that we're looking at the moment.
Oh,
And
okay.
like ourselves, there are also other undervalued companies in Nevada. And we do think it's a good time to be consolidating a very prospective district while everyone's asleep, basically.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad to hear you say you're not going to raise money at 6 cents a share or whatever it is now, 8 cents a share Canadian. No, as a shareholder, I'm glad to hear that. Next round, much higher, I hope.
Yeah, I hope so. I
Right.
think it's very, very much market driven. And now we've seen gold push through 1900, and there's a correlation with our share price and the gold price. So let's see gold hit 2000 and see where we're at.
Well, I think it's a matter of time, I believe. I hope, anyway. Cherry, thank you so much for sharing your thoughts about this exciting story. I think it's exciting. Market obviously isn't excited in it right now, but when you look at the potential low price, I like the story a lot and really be watching closely for the new PEA, the updated PEA, which I will obviously pass along to my subscribers and to people who view this channel. Thank you so much.
Thank you for your time, Jay.
You bet. All right, folks. So, well, don't go away because Alistair MacLeod will be with me in just a moment. Welcome back to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor. I should mention that the sponsor for today's show is Gold Bull Resources. You just heard from Sherry Leadon. She is the geologist of that company. Have about 500,000 ounces of gold to start with in Nevada, but lots of exploration potential. And so it's a company that I've added to my newsletter, Gold Bowl Resources. And of course, you can listen to that on the first segment of this week's show. But right now, I'm really happy to tell you that Alistair MacLeod is with me once again, one of our most popular guests, I should say. Really want to talk to him today about interest rates, a silent killer. That's a piece that he wrote recently, a couple of weeks ago, I guess, on gold money. And I should say, as I always like to remind you, that every Thursday, Alistair puts out a wonderful piece, very important work that he does in helping people understand the markets as they really are, as opposed to the propaganda that is imposed on us, or we're supposed to believe they are. Alistair helps us keep that straight, what is, as opposed to what is the politicians tell us is supposed to be. So every Thursday, that is, Alistair's essays are up, and again, I can't recommend them highly enough. Thank you, Alistair, for joining me once again.
Thank you for your kind words, Jay.
Well, they're certainly genuine. They're heartfelt. You've been a great friend of this show, for going back to the radio show for many years, and you've been very helpful. And as I say, you are one of our more popular guests. So, let's start out with what's happened earlier this week, the Silicon Valley Bank failure. And then we're seeing some others, the Signature Bank, which is also a big one. I think I saw the second and third largest bank failures in American history just this week. We're seeing it. Is this the start of something big here, Alistair? Do you think this is a contagion type of situation, or do you think they can contain it?
I hope they can contain it, but the difficulty they are going to have, I think, is convincing the banks which are still solvent or still trading, as it were, that everything is all right. The reason I mention this is that we are likely to see a seizure in wholesale money markets. The importance of wholesale money markets is this. When a bank finds that it's got deposits have gone out, we won't say it's a crisis or anything like that, but when deposits have gone out, mm-hmm. it needs to retain the balance on its balance sheet. So it needs to borrow funds from other banks. Mm-hmm. That is the function of, some people call it a clearing system, others would call it an interbank market or wholesale money markets. Now, the way it works is that every bank will have files on all the other banks that it has traded with in the past in the interbank market, and management would have put limits on the positions which a bank has with all the other banks.
Sure.
And very often it would probably be not really so much an examination of the internal, if you like, balance sheet and the condition of the bank. But, you know, if Moody's has given it a rating, then, you know, sort of, let's say Moody's says AA+ or something like that, then, you know, you probably say, okay, we'll put a limit of $5 million on that. So mm-hmm. that, you know, if that bank, you know, sort of through the money market approaches you and says, I'd like to borrow $3.5 million or whatever, you know, it goes like that.
Yeah.
The problem with that is that these events will have triggered concerns in every bank in that market. They will be acutely conscious of any unusual movements. So if, let us say, the bank I've just said sort of comes on and says, you know, we would like to borrow $4 million, you know, you find that the traders in the bank you're trying to borrow from will probably think, hold on a minute, their record is they've borrowed sort of $500,000, whatever, and it's gone $500,000 the other way with us and so on. So I mean, it's $4 million. Yeah, what's going on here?
Yeah.
Do you see what I mean? You can see how the risk element really does show in the foreign exchange markets. Now, I have no doubt, if we can look just a bit beyond the American situation, that Credit Suisse is finding this problem at the moment in Switzerland. Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, we know that deposits have been running out of the door mm-hmm. In Credit Suisse. So where does it go to get the balance? I mean, do you want to lend money to Credit Suisse? Most banks would say no. One route is Credit Suisse could probably do a repo with you. because that is collateralized.
Yeah.
But again, you know, do you really want to have a collateralized swap effectively with a bank which is in that condition? Yes, bit sort of maybe not maybe.
Yeah.
So you can see how suddenly these problems mount up. And I think way back in the 19th century, the Bank of Glasgow shut down because, well, it went bust because the London banks just, you know, they saw what was going on in the bank. They didn't like what they saw and they refused to lend to it. So bang, that was it. We've got a similar situation today. So in a sense, while all the focus is on, you know, depositors and our depositors moving their deposits out elsewhere and all the rest of it, that's just one aspect of it. The thing that really will determine whether smaller banks have real difficulties and are forced, if you like, to go to the Fed, is really, you know, if you like, the conditions in the money markets. And I would say that any trader in the interbank market is going to basically want to not trade.
Yeah.
So you will get a suspension in effect of activity in the wholesale money markets. Now that basically is death to the whole system.
Right.
I'm not saying that's definitely going to happen. I'm not going to say that it's something that's going to be more than a few days or maybe a week or so, but you can see where the danger comes from.
Mm-hmm.
And that I think is a very, very important point to understand.
Right. So it seizes up. It's an illiquidity event, essentially, right?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It seizes up and nobody trades and the wheels of commerce can't turn. Then.
I mean, if you sort of, you know, go back to the old days when, you know, you queued up round the block to take your money out of the bank, that was the visible equivalent, if you like, of what actually happens in the digital market.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's something that happens, I think, as much as anything between banks, as well as between, say, depositors moving from one bank to another. And of course, the other thing about it is that retail depositors are protected. I think it's protected to $250,000 in America. So in a sense, I think, you know, obviously it makes it less likely that the small depositor will panic.
Mm-hmm.
But anyone with more than $250,000 on balance is, you know, going to say, well, oh, you know, they're going to start looking at their positions very, very closely.
Sure.
And they will probably, there's a lot of sense in running out and buying treasury bills. If you've got that sort of money.
Right.
Take it out of the banking system entirely.
Exactly.
I would recommend, actually, that by far the best thing you can do, and this is a more, if you like, a wider economic point, is just get out of fiat currency and get into gold.
Right. Well, of course. And
anyway, I won't go down that route unless.
No, of course. Well, yeah. I mean, you are talking your book a bit, Alistair. It's the gold money, after all. But I know that you've been an advocate of gold money long before gold money was even created. So I know where you stand, and I'm with you on that as well. Mm-hmm. I'd like to get to your article, Interest Rates, the Silent Killer. In that article, you mentioned, you're expecting interest rates to continue to rise. You're expecting inflation to continue to rise. And of course, over the last number of credit cycles, we've seen the Fed comes in, raises rates, the economy, the markets crash, the economy comes down, and price inflation is abated, at least it declines dramatically. This time, are you suggesting it's different? Are you suggesting that inflation isn't going to come under control so easily this time, and therefore interest rates can't be brought down as they were in prior cycles?
Well, interest. I mean, yes. I mean, inflation is not going to come down, and I can tell you that the moves by the central banks, not just the Fed, but the Bank of England, Swiss National Bank, even having mentioned Credit Suisse,
mm-hmm.
The Bank of Japan, where the rate has fallen on the 10-year bond quite substantially, and the ECB. I mean, they're all actually going to try and rescue their systems at the expense of their currencies. And if you understand that it is currencies falling in terms of their value measured in goods that we're really talking about, not prices going up,
mm-hmm.
That's just the visible effect, but it's the purchasing power's falling. You can see that the currency debasement that is going to result from rescuing the entire financial system is going to be substantial. And the relationship between the loss of purchasing power of a currency and interest rates is that the interest rate is the compensation with it, which a depositor requires for him to hold on to the currency, as opposed to getting out of the currency entirely. And this is particularly important when you consider the situation for foreign investors in dollars, for example, of which, and I've said this so many times before, something like trillion dollars in US financial assets and on deposit in the US banks. So the foreigners actually have a huge interest in getting the return right from the dollar. And if the dollar's purchasing power starts falling more rapidly, which is the inevitable consequence of prioritizing the system over the currency, then you are going to see what we call inflation rise, and you're going to see interest rates tend to follow it. Now, the Fed can sit on interest rates. Of course it can. We've seen that. We've seen even the ECB and the Bank of Japan turning them negative, which is a completely unnatural phenomenon. But actually, what we're seeing is we're seeing contracting bank lending. The cycle of bank credit is contracting, and there's no doubt about that whatsoever. It's become visible. I've been talking about it ever since Jamie Dimon. Do you remember he stood up at a conference in New York?
Yes.
Said, I'm upgrading this, the financial outlook or the economic outlook, from storm to hurricane.
Right.
Ever since then, that to me was a very clear signal that there was the most senior banker in the world saying that he was going to start controlling the risk in his balance sheet, which is the same thing as, you know, contracting it in effect in real terms. And when we can see that now, quarter on quarter, it is contracting, and we have not seen money supply, US money supply, contract to this extent, I think, since records really began. I mean, certainly going back to the 50s, we're talking about post-war, really. So this is an important change. And what it means in terms of pricing credit is that if you get contracting credit and you've got an awful lot of people who need to refinance their positions, then interest rates, if insofar as they are the price of obtaining that credit, are going to rise. It doesn't matter what the Fed does. The Fed can say it's zero.
Right.
But, you know, in all practicality, you go to a bank as a businessman and say, I want to roll this, or I want to do this, that, I need to borrow some money. You know, the bank will probably turn around and say, sorry, we're not lending to anyone. Or if they actually very much like your face, they might turn around and say, yeah, we'll make some money available, not as much as you wanted, but the price is going to be X. You know, and so, you know, I think this is a point which everybody misses. Everybody thinks that the Fed actually controls interest rates. No, they don't. They control the rate at which they intervene in the market.
Right.
But in the real world of banking, you know, really what you're looking at now is not the greed of getting business in the door, but you're looking at the fear of losses. And the fear of losses is coming really from three points. The one is that it's coming from falling financial asset values. Excuse me. Falling financial asset values. It will be coming increasingly from loan losses, bad debts, and so on and so forth. And the other problem you have is that the wholesale markets for money are freezing up.
Right.
So you haven't got the liquidity to create loans, even if you wanted to. And this is, you know, so really it comes back to your first question, you know, is this just a sort of flash in the pan, or is this something more serious? I mean, it looks to me as if it is something more serious. Yeah. We've been talking about an impending banking crisis on, you know, you and I have been talking about this for well over a year now, and it's finally arrived.
Yeah, it sure seems as though it has. In your essay, you talked about the inevitable collapse of the Western banking system, the emphasis on the Western banking system. And who would you include then? It would be the NATO countries for sure, led by the United States and the European Union, the UK, Japan, I suppose, Australia, New Zealand. Who's in there and who's not a part of the Western banking system? I mean, everybody, of course, to an extent, is going to be related to it. It's going to impact China and Russia and those countries that are on the other side as well, I suppose. But give us your thinking in terms of why the Western banking system might be separate from what takes place in Asia.
Well, the Western banking system is a fiat currency system, right? Yeah. Led by the dollar. The dollar is, if you like, numero uno fiat currency. So all credit links to another form of credit.
Right.
It doesn't link to money, it links to another form of credit. And that's an inherently unstable situation, as we're now finding out. The other side, if you like, of what I call the Western Alliance is obviously the Asian hegemons. You know, we're talking about the axis, if you like, between Russia and China. And they have, through the Eurasian Economic Union, through the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, through BRICS Plus, they have got on their side roughly 4 billion people or governments ruling 4 billion people or responsible for that sort of number. Whereas the Western Alliance, as I would call it, which really, let's just talk in terms of NATO, Five Eyes, mm-hmm. Japan, and a few others, you know, maybe Philippines and so on. We're looking at about 1.1 billion, you know, so this is far smaller. I mean, we're talking about probably only a third of the population on our side, and we're all declining. We, you know, we're all sort of going woke over this and that and the other thing and trying to do away with fossil fuels compared with an industrial revolution, which is undoubtedly underway throughout the whole of Asia. When it comes to currencies, I mean, it's quite clear that our currencies, being entirely fiat, are in some sort of long-term decline. Will be hiccups. There could be situations which lead to their complete destruction. I mean, we could be looking at that event now. But when you look at what's going on in Asia, essentially, their currencies are backed by real production, real commodities, real things.
Right.
Unlike us, we're just, you know, we're just a speculative bubble in all this. What they need to do is to tie their currencies to something that protects them from the collapse, which we, you know, we appear to be now entering. And I note that President Xi is visiting President Putin in Moscow. Right. This has been brought forward, as I understand it, to next week.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I think that it's been brought forward basically because of the banking situation in the West. The need for these Asian hegemons to protect themselves from a currency collapse in the West is now absolutely vital. I think that they will advance their plans, whatever they are, for securing the purchasing power of their currencies against that collapse. My view is that they will do it with a trade currency. They have been working on this for some time. The leader is a guy called Sergei, what's his name? Sergei Glazyev. And he wrote an article in a business magazine in Moscow, or business paper, clearly laying out that he was going in the direction of gold. So I would expect to see some sort of new currency for trade purposes only, for the pricing of commodities in markets throughout Asia, which will be basically gold and gold backed, if you like. I mean, I would have thought that you could probably have currency 40% backed by gold, which is what Sir Isaac Newton came up with when he was master of the Royal Mint back in 1720, if my dates are about right. That stood for the test of time. And I think that's the sort of way they're going to go. And it will allow individual countries to run their own affairs. They won't be forced to go onto a gold standard. Yeah. But if they want to, you know, if that's the way they go, that's the way they go. And I think that the advantage of creating a new trade currency, which is completely independent of political vested interests, is it can be done very, very quickly. with everybody agreeing to do it because they don't have to lose any face in the process.
Yeah. Well, okay, that's the Asian bloc, but what about how are we going to respond to it? How's the United States going to respond to it? If anything, it sort of just despises gold. I mean, it's gold, it shines a light on what it's doing, essentially. I mean, if you have gold prices rising, the dollar loses credibility, and you know, they don't want to see that. If anything, no thief likes to have the lights go on when they're breaking into a house. I mean, why in the world would the United, I guess what I'm asking is, how is the United States going to respond to this in your view?
Well, so far, what the United States has done is it's used the dollar basically to bankrupt anyone who challenges them.
Yeah.
I mean, we've seen this, Indonesia back in, I can't remember when it was, a long time ago, Suharto, like during those days. Mm-hmm. We've seen it in various other countries. And the Chinese have a view on this. They've examined, how the Thai baht crisis, the Asian crisis in, was it 98? All that sort of stuff. And as far as they're concerned, as far as the Chinese are concerned, this was engineered by the American government. Now, I don't know whether that's right or wrong. I mean, there's enough evidence that they do intervene and they will do regime change or whatever. But I think that the days when the Americans can really sort of force people to stay on the side of the dollar, I think that's dying. I think that's gone. They certainly can't do it in Asia. And I think that there's a very clear indication of the end of this trade when Mohammed bin Salman in Saudi Arabia said, we're perfectly prepared to accept renminbi. And in that case, of course, they've got the financial markets in Shanghai and Hong Kong to be able to switch out of renminbi into gold. Mm-hmm. And I would expect them to do that to some extent. I think they'll hold renminbi, but they'll probably hold 10% of their net trade surplus in gold. So that is the way it's going. And there's nothing, I'm afraid, that we in the West could do about it.
Right.
We have lost our power. We had a last throw of the dice trying to bankrupt the Russians. And what happened? We ended up bankrupting ourselves.
Yeah.
So, the days of dollar hegemony are over. Mm-hmm. And I take the point that this is something that's coming very, very hard to the deep state, if I can call it that.
Yeah.
Your deep state, our deep state, whatever, is coming very, very hard to our economic establishments because mm-hmm. they're all sold on Keynesianism, and sometimes they drift towards monetarism. They don't drift towards sound money. They always drift into the manipulation of things. There's got to be a whole re-education process to occur before we get it right. Mm-hmm. I mean, nobody's going to employ me to do it, I can assure you. But you could see where the difficulties are mountainous. Now, my own personal view is that there will come a point where all this is swept aside and someone turns around and says, look, there's only one way out of this. At the moment, 1 ounce of gold buys $100,000 or whatever the figure is, mm-hmm. And it's getting worse. We've got to stop it. Mm-hmm. We've got to use the dollar as the means of getting gold back into the system.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, we will have a fixed exchange rate, whatever that is, in order to do that. Now, you've got to get to the situation where the vested interests in mm-hmm. the deep state, in, if you like, the visible state, the Democratic and Republican parties and their electorates and all the rest of it, they've got to accept that this is the only way out of the mess.
Right.
And then we can start.
Right.
Then we can start, but only then. So this is not something that's going to happen. I mean, let's say that the price of gold, or rather, the price of the dollar sinks to one five thousandth of an ounce.
Yeah.
At that stage, they're not going to sort of say, oh, we'll go back on a gold standard. No, because they don't have the, they don't have the understanding. They don't have the intellectual support to deal with a process which is just totally out of their control.
Right. So how do they get that intellectual process? I mean, is it going to take an enormous amount of pain? And there's, you know, you got to hit bottom sometimes before things get better. You have to recognize there's no other way out. And you look at the Asian bloc and realize they're trading, they're prospering, they're doing well. And, but, you know, Alistair, the military industrial complex, how can it continue to run if the dollar continues to lose its value? I mean, how can it finance itself?
Well,
we've been borrowing from foreigners for so long that are no longer willing to lend. I suppose, you know, what interest rate would it take to get the Chinese to buy treasuries again? To get the
I can tell you they won't. They won't, because they're now, as I said earlier, they're now looking to protect themselves from an inevitable catastrophe in Western currencies. So they're not going to come in and buy treasuries at any price.
Right.
And I think your point about defense spending is actually a very important one, because when President Xi and President Putin meet next week, I think they will actually, one of the things that will come up is the way this is going is possibly towards a nuclear war, that we're talking about Taiwan and we're talking about Ukraine.
Yeah.
The only way we can defuse that is to bankrupt the United States. So we have got to take measures, not just to protect ourselves, but to destroy the ability of the United States to finance its defense spending.
Well, that's pretty dire. And, from my point of view, I don't see how the military industrial complex can control itself. I don't see how it can stop. There's no interest in having any kind of a peaceful solution to Ukraine. The propaganda here is totally against that. We hear only about how evil Putin is and how righteous we are. And, you know, I mean, so you think this could be a really big deal then next week, I guess, with Xi going to visit Putin?
I'm speculating, but I'm just sort of trying to think through, you know, why is this being brought forward? Has it something to do with current banking troubles in the West? But yeah. I think the conclusion has to be logically yes. I mean, if you just put yourself in their shoes. I mean, right. You know, what do you do when you see your enemies? I put that in inverted commas because we call ourselves friends. Well, we call everybody friend, you know, our friends in America. When you see your enemies, if you like, you know, sort of destroying themselves and in the process probably destroying you if you don't do anything about it, you have got to react. And that's really where China and Russia are now. I think there's no doubt about that.
Well, Alistair, we're supposed to have some gold, a fair amount of gold, and not as much as the Chinese, according to your the numbers I've seen you publish recently, and even the Russians maybe. I don't know exactly how much gold we have. You would have that number in your head, I'm sure. But we're told we have a sizable amount of gold, even though, as I understand it, has not been independently audited since Dwight Eisenhower was president. Mm. So, I mean, if we have a hoard of gold, wouldn't it theoretically be possible at some price to back the dollar with gold again? If these guys could understand the merit of it?
Of course, absolutely. I think one of the questions is how much gold is there? Because in order to stabilize the dollar, unless you're going to go back to a coin exchange standard, where literally you say we've got enough gold, this is what we've got. And if you don't believe it, come and exchange your dollars for physical gold at whatever the set price is. And we will stand there and we will do that all day, every day, mm-hmm. as long as it is required. Mm-hmm. Yeah. In the absence of that, I think that the markets will need convincing is exactly what the gold position is. There are two things which I would like to draw to your attention. The first is the difficulty that Germany had getting its gold repatriated.
Yeah.
That rather indicated that not all was right. Mm-hmm. In fact, I'll say three things. The stories that have emanated from the fall of the Libyan government, from the fall of the Ukrainian government, the color revolution, and so on, the first people in there seem to be SEALs or, you know, people in Black Hawk helicopters coming in and taking all the gold. there is some evidence which I can't evaluate how good that evidence is, but there has been evidence, some evidence that sort of thing has been going on. And the third thing I would mention is probably the most important, which might explain both the other two, and that is the level of leases and swaps that have gone on to artificially increase the quantity of gold, of official gold, rather suggests to me that America has been very much involved with that. And given the amount of gold which is now in Asian hands and not stored in London, in New York, or in Paris, or indeed in Frankfurt, or in Switzerland, you can see that that is where the double counting in terms of leasing and swaps is all based. And so, I mean, Frank Veneroso worked this out back in 2002 when he made a speech in Lima. And he said at the time that his estimate, and he'd researched this very, very thoroughly, talking to people who were prepared to talk to him. His estimate was that somewhere between 10,000 and 14,000 tons, at that stage, the total official gold holdings were 28,000 tons of all the central banks. So up to half the gold was out on lease. And the way he put it was being worn by Asian women. So now, I think things have got a bit more sophisticated since then, you know, but what you've got at the very least is you've got a lot of gold in official vaults, which have got more than one owner. And so going on to a gold standard for the West is going to have to deal with that situation.
We're going to have to know how many ounces we really have, in other words.
Not how many we say we have.
Yes, exactly. So there needs to be an audit, an independent audit. I don't know. I don't think there's too many fans of that. Ron Paul wanted that, and various, a few others, crackpot gold bugs, of course, Alistair, you know, but.
But the two audits that need to be done. One is the physical audit, seeing whether the gold is actually there.
Yeah.
And the second is establishing who actually owns it.
Well, exactly. I mean, I've known there are people like, well, I won't mention any names that have gone to the vaults and said, well, we see it's all there. Yeah, but who owns it is the question. Because I know the Gold Antitrust Action folks have been doing a lot of work over the years and showing that there is, you know, they lend it out, they lease it out to other people and claim it's still there. And that's happened at least at more than one central bank, I believe. So who knows? Well, anyway, just in wrapping up here, you know, since 1971, I mean, this is when we really started down this slippery slope, I think, of thinking we could have our cake and eat it too. Live beyond our means now, distort interest rates so nobody really understands capital allocation. And it encourages us to do all kinds of things, consume and not produce in America and the West in general, I guess, except for Germany. They've been a very strong producing nation. Maybe the UK, no, not so much. They've been also financialized like we have, I think. How should investors, I guess, sit where we are now? We are where we are, and there's not much we can do about it except, you know, you and I and people of our ilk, we've been buying gold over the years. We've recognized there would be a day of reckoning. But right now, what should people do? And everybody's in a different position, of course. But if you have some cash, I guess, number one, you'd say get out of fiat, right? And buy real stuff, have something tangible that they can't take away from you. They can't inflate away from you. They can always, governments can do anything they want when they have the power. They can take anything. They can even take our gold as they did in the United States in the 19, you know, as Roosevelt did, right? $10,000 fine and 10 years in prison if you got caught not turning in your gold. That was at least on the books. Thank God we've gotten rid of that law. But just in summing up, what should people be doing? First of all, they should be reading your report every Thursday. That's number one. They should be going to the Gold Money's website, which I do all the time. Okay, I'll let you talk now.
Well, yes, I mean, I certainly read my stuff, and I hope most of it is understandable, because I am actually writing for, you know, a sort of a range of people from, right, you know, sure, quite senior economists down to, you know, the ordinary person. So it can be a little difficult to get the balance. I hope that, you know, with a bit of sort of exercising the brain a bit, even, you know, sort of someone who is not terribly literate financially can understand it. That's, yes, that is very much a mission of mine. The answer really, I think, is quite simple. If you think that what I'm saying makes sense, and you think that there is a severe danger that the financial system of the West is likely to fall over for whatever reason, then it makes sense for you to get however much you decide you want to protect from this event into legal money. And legal money, going all the way back to Roman times, is gold, silver, and copper. Now, gold is basically, if you like, the yardstick by which we mention, you know, it's the one metal which actually is at the top of that pile. And sure. It is the one which will come back to back currencies to stabilize the situation at the end of the day. Silver is, if you like, it's more for the small change, mind you. The way when the currency goes down, small change would be could be many thousands of dollars. I mean, in an extreme situation. Right. So I would strongly, I don't give investment advice, but I would ask people to consider very, very seriously their position. If I am right, and the purchasing power of your currency goes down the toilet, how are you going to protect yourself from that? Mm-hmm. Throughout history, it has always been by, if you like, turning your back on credit and owning real money. It's the Gresham's law, if you like, the superior money. You know, bad money drives out the good from circulation. What do? You spend the bad stuff and you hang on to the good stuff. That was really about, you know, clipped coins going back into the Elizabethan times. But this sort of metaphor actually does work in the relationship between gold and credit. Credit is intangible. Gold is tangible.
Right.
And any paper that represents gold should be avoided, because paper is credit. Right. That's all it is. Right. Whether it's shares in an ETF, whether it's futures, whether it's a promise from a bank, you know, we'll offer you an unallocated account, or, you know, we will store your gold and we will record it, if you like, as that. And they might use that gold in order to trade. You've got to be very, very careful how you look after physical money.
Right.
Make sure it's yours. Make sure you have it under your control. And you can do either that by having some coins at home, which I would strongly recommend. But you can't obviously have too much, and particularly don't tell anyone you've got any gold or silver, because, you know, that's just inviting trouble. But the other thing you can do with a gold money account, and I mean, there will be other people who I'm sure offer a similar service, is you can have your gold, silver, platinum group metals stored abroad in a fully insured, fully compliant vault. And you know, I would say that an American might think, well, in case they try and confiscate my gold again, if it's in Switzerland, it'll make it more difficult for them to do it, for example. So that's why we have a range of vaults around the world. It's really to suit everybody. Right. And it's really as simple as that. And I think, I mean, we don't often get into this conversation, but when you see banks beginning to fail and you can see the dynamics that are underneath it, it's actually time, I think, to have this conversation.
Yeah, I agree with you. And of course, a lot of people don't even realize that when they put their money in a deposit in a commercial bank, they are lending to the bank, and it's an unsecured loan they're making to the bank. If we put our shares in a brokerage house, same thing. In America, at least, we don't really own those shares. We have an account, we can get our shares, we can sell them. We can get cash back from them, but if things go belly up, the brokerage firms, they actually are the owners, as I understand it, Alistair. Is that your understanding as well?
Well, no, they're not. They're not the owners. I mean, a broker basically, unless you are borrowing money against them, you know, like sort of having a leveraged position.
Yeah, okay.
But otherwise, no, it is your property. But unfortunately, it is property, if you like, in the sense that you have an entitlement to it.
Yeah.
But it's actually registered on someone else's computer.
Exactly. So
you don't. You don't have a a share certificate issued by the company in your hand anymore. It's gone completely electronic.
Right, right. So if the brokerage firm goes down, then what happens? You're insured to a certain extent.
If the brokerage firm goes down, then you should still have your shares on the system, unless you've pledged them.
Yeah.
But what can happen and I have seen this before, is when a brokerage firm goes down, all the shares held by the banks in the name of the brokerage company on behalf of their clients just get sold.
Right.
So you've lost it. Now, this happened back in, I can tell you, there was a firm called Chapman and Rowe, a London stockbroking firm. They were hammered, which was the technical term for declared defaulters on the London Stock Exchange, in 1972, I think it was, late 1972. And I know that what happened was that they had a client's ledger, and in the ledger, they differentiated between stock held as collateral against loans and stock which was held for safe custody. But the bank wasn't told. The bank which took these shares as sort of, as collateral and safe custody, were not told that there were two separate categories. So consequently, when the firm was hammered, the first thing that they did was they sold all the shares. Boom. It actually worked out very well for everybody, except the manager. I think the managing partner who went to jail on it. But it actually worked out well for the clients because the FT30 share index, which we had in those days, collapsed from, at the time, something like, 450, something like that. And it went down to 170 at one stage after that. So you can see that actually it worked out pretty well for everybody. They had everything sold out.
Well, at least that time it did.
At a better price than they would have got otherwise. But not, this is the sort of thing that can happen. So don't rely, in extremis when you get a banking problem, banking system failures, and all the rest of it. Don't rely on your property being protected within that system.
Right. You have various ETFs and things like that that aren't, you're not necessarily protected. So
Jay, you can have shares in an ETF, but you don't have gold. You have an entitlement,
exactly.
Maybe, but you don't actually have gold.
Exactly right. Now, at gold money, the gold, I mean, this is the integrity of gold money, I think, is the reason that I have some value there. It's you have regular audits, I believe, and also, I have confidence that the gold is there. So if I need it, I can get it. Have tried it and have had had some hard money sent our way here in America, but it's all about confidence, isn't it? And anybody
well,
that
it has is
confidence it, in fiat, I don't know where yeah. why you would.
But it is also the legal position. You can either act as a custodian, which in Latin law is you have made a deposit, a depositum, as it were, right. Or you can put your gold into a bank and get a credit as a result. And that is known as a mutuum in Roman law. Yeah. And it's still the case today. It's the difference between custody and banking. It's either held as your property, not on the bank's balance sheet or the institution's balance sheet, or it is on the bank's balance sheet. In the latter case, you're a creditor of the bank if anything goes wrong.
Right.
Well, even if it doesn't go wrong, you are a creditor.
Yes.
But in the former case, and you will find that even today, the regulators insist, quite rightly, on a very, very rigid line between stuff held in custody and stuff which actually goes on to an institution's balance sheet as an obligation in return for something that was already being put in.
Right. Well, I want to thank you very much, Alistair, for that explanation. I think it's probably something I want to explore a little bit more in American law as well, to make sure that I haven't given somebody the wrong answers to something. I know you know for sure what's going on in London and the UK. I suppose you know as well as I about what happens here, but it's something I think, you know, when times are good, you don't worry about these things. But when things start to look a little shaky, you have to start paying attention. I want to thank you so much, Alistair, for your generous sharing of your time once again. It's great to see you feeling better. I mean, you were really something the way you battled through that last time, and got a lot of people watched and really enjoyed, as always. Thank you so much for being with us once again.
Very much my pleasure, Jay. Thanks for having me back.
You bet. All right, folks. Well, that is it for this week. If you like this this interview with Alistair, make sure you hit the like button and sign up for this channel, subscribe to this channel. And next week, Keith Weiner will be with me, and Kimberly Ann. And until then, goodbye and God's blessings to you.